And if it seems to be a lot of interference, then I'll mention this again throughout the teleconference. So, taking a breath. Well, welcome to everyone. This is August 22nd, 2009, and this is a teleconference on Pathwork Guide Lecture 44, which is the forces of love, eros, and sex. And I was privileged to work with John Parakas for a period of time when I studied core energetics, and he always called his workshops love, eros, and sex. And people said, why? And he said, because it gets people to show up. And besides, that's what it's all about anyway. So that was part of my initial teaching, is that love, eros, and sex is what everything is about. And then when I really discovered the Pathwork lectures, I found that to be true. And that's how I approach this lecture, on a personal level, but also on a universal and spiritual level. So to start off with, there's a real tenderness in this lecture. And within the tenderness and the gentleness of the guide's words, there's also a slight bit of bad news for those of us who are single. Because depending on how you choose to read the lecture, you can choose to read the lecture as if being in relationship is the penultimate human experience, and if you're not in a relationship, you have a problem. I want to be very firm and strong about this, that that is an interpretation, and that is not what the lecture says. But it can give an impression that this lecture is about people in relationship or who want to be in relationship. And so the question that comes up is, what if you're single? What if you're single and that's how you have been, and perhaps that's how you may be for some period of time? If you're older, perhaps for the rest of your life. This has been my situation for the past couple of decades. So I did a lot of thinking about this. You know, what about me? This sounds so luscious and so wonderful and so divine and spiritual. Where's mine? What do I do to find love, eros, and sex? And from the beginning with my teaching in core energetics and in pathwork, what was brought to me, what was offered to me, is that more universal sense of what this lecture is about. And so there's a place where, yes, you can experience all these in a human relationship, but you can also experience all of these feelings, depth of feelings, movements, soul movements. All these things exist in many, many other aspects of life. I mention this to draw this from the personal or the human up into a larger reality that every human being experiences these three forces. And it's just a matter of where you are at the moment as to how you may hear the word. But when I read the guide with an open mind, I find that the words are always inclusive if you choose to see it that way. And that
excuse me, just a sec. I just wanted to let you all know that I'm here. This is Joseph.
Oh, welcome, Joseph. Glad to have you.
Thanks. Sorry to interrupt.
That's all right. I appreciate interruptions. Let me say this. If you have any questions or you don't understand what I'm saying, heaven knows I'm not always clear. Go ahead and interrupt, because it's important. The information is being given as a communication, and if it doesn't communicate or if I don't even know you're there, then that kind of leaves off an element of communication. So I'm glad to know who's on board, even though we've turned the chimes off. So when I was reading the lecture, once again, trying to keep an open mind about what this lecture is about and hearing how it's phrased in terms of personal, intimate human relationships, and wanting to also hear how that would affect me as a single person, I was reminded of a teaching that is given by a Pathwork helper who formed the Philadelphia Pathwork. Her name is Carolyn Tylove. And she wrote a very brief little paper, and she gives it sometimes at leadership meetings, called How to Read a Lecture. And I found her point of view exciting and refreshing. And that is that what she said was, when you're reading a lecture, don't run over the speed bumps. As you're reading a lecture, when you, that makes you hesitate, brings up feeling or brings up memory or anything that stops the flow of the movement of your reading the lecture, don't just run over it and keep going. Pause and reflect, because the truth is that the meaning of this lecture could come in the first paragraph for you. And the rest of the lecture, just that isn't for you. It's the sentence in the first paragraph that hits you. And I'll explain in a moment how that fits into Eros. So along with her discussion of this, what was delightful about it was what she said was, sometimes when I'm not in a really good mood, I stop dead on greetings, my dear friends, which is the introduction to many, many of the lectures. Now, there's a lot of background noise that just went on. If you think that might be you on a mobile phone, if you could help, that's very distracting. There we go. Thank you. So, Carolyn says, stop when you hit a phrase that hits you, and sometimes if that's the very, very first words, greeting my dear friends, stop there and deal with the feelings that come up at that moment, rather than racing ahead. Okay? So as I'm reading the lecture, I think it was in the first paragraph, well, I got hit with it with a sentence. And because of her teaching, instead of racing ahead, I paused and reflected on that one sentence. So I invite you, as you read through the lecture, to consider whatever strikes you, whatever calls to you, whether it's positive or negative, stop there and be real with what is happening to you in the moment as you read the information. It makes the lectures fresh and alive and gives you different places to go, because you'll stop at different places during different readings. So in reading through this, so the joke is love, Eros, and sex, and the sex part's kind of titillating. People, well, what does Guide say about sex? So I thought that I would go through them a bit, and I thought I'd go ahead and start with sex. And one of the reasons is that in September, I'm going to be doing a whole teleconference on Lecture 07, which is the spiritual significance of sexuality. So I didn't think that I needed to devote too much time in this teleconference to that. And for those of you who are most interested in that, we at first on the plate. Like John said, that's what people are interested in. So what the guide teaches about the sex force is, in one simple sentence, the sex is the creative force on any level of existence. The sex force is the creative force on any level of existence. So as I said in the beginning, if you can hear this on a primal human level, you can hear it on a species or civilization level, but you can also hear this in the unitive plane, that the sex force, expressed in different ways and in different phases and energetic realms, is the of the universe. Again, I'm hearing a lot of background noise. If people could hit star 6 and silence, it would be appreciated. Thank you. So sex being an active force, whether it is expressed in sexuality on the planet with humans, or as a force alone of creative, procreative force in a spiritual, emotional, or even intellectual effort. So that is the position that the guide takes about sexuality, acknowledging it is a major human event. So he goes on to say that pure sex, the sex force alone, without Eros and without love, is utterly selfish. Now again, you can read that as saying, oh, I must be bad when I'm having sex. Or you could consider that it simply is utterly selfish. And if sex is the creative force in the universe, the most powerful creative force, then what quality of being purely selfish mixes with being a powerful creative force in the universe? It would sound like these two don't fit. And yet the guide is saying that this would be about the pure sexual force, once again, without the influences of love and without the influences of Eros. So the fact that something in its purity is fundamentally self-centered does not make it negative or bad, but it is something to consider. If that is true, and there's always an if, when you're reading the Pathric Lectures, the guide is very, very clear. Do not accept what he says. Think about it, work with it, argue with it. It is a gift for you to consider, not a command. So in terms of sex as the possibly being utterly selfish, what would that mean? And the guide goes on to say that, for instance, if sex mixes with love, such as in a long-term relationship, there can be affection, there can be caring, there are a number of very, very positive elements in a relationship. But without the element of Eros, lacks a spark. That when you mix sex and Eros, you can get a lot of energy going. And yet, that energy doesn't have any place to land if there is only sex and Eros. So there's a driving force and a spark of energy, a soul movement of exploration. With those two together, it is possible that this could remain in an area of actual avoidance of long-term intimacy. And I think that explains what the guide is saying about sex alone being utterly selfish. That movement and creativity without consideration of another is about our creativity and our driving force and our ability to manifest in the world, in energy and in spirit, rather than about relationship or a loving community with other people. So without going into negativity about selfish, the sex force simply isn't complete in and of itself. The other thing that the guide speaks about is that sexuality always manifests at first in a very selfish and immature way. That's how we are as we grow up. And because a lot of human beings are not spiritually strongly developed, there's a lot of sexuality on the planet that isn't mature. And so societies have had to deal with this. They've had to deal with the strong creative force that is being moved and held by people who are not particularly emotionally or spiritually mature. And that this has led to the condemnation of sex among cultures and philosophies. And again, this is where I found a bit of tenderness. He simply says that was in response to a reality, that because sex was misused and misunderstood and misapplied, it became aligned with badness and became, equivocated, but it's some word like that. Equivocated is not the right word. But sex equals sin is in effect a solution to the difficulties of the fact that we haven't fully developed and we haven't certainly matured all around across the planet in our attitudes towards sexuality. And of course, once sex is put right next to sin and hooked to it, then we don't want to go there. So it's an invitation for a terrible vicious circle where sexuality remains immature and underdeveloped because it's been associated with negative aspects of human life. So that kind of wraps up sex. That's really all the time the guide spends on sexuality in this lecture. So the next thing I'd like to take a look at is love. There isn't a specific lecture on love in the positive. In fact,
Jan?
Yes.
what you just said about the immaturity of that seems to me is what the creation of the word lust expresses.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And if one is fearful of being lustful, then they might shortchange themselves by being fearful of following through legitimate expression.
Yes. So on some level, you could think of lust as being like, what's the word for wanting to eat a lot? I've forgotten the word.
Gluttonous?
Gluttonous, yes. On some level, you can think of lust as being gluttonous. If we have felt starved for both nutrition and pleasure in food, we may tend to reach out with great voracity and overeat or grab things and literally shove them in our mouth because we are missing out on some of the key elements of the pleasure of eating. And lust might be analogous to that in the sense of, because we don't have a mature and lovely experience of sex, and yet we want the experience because we really intuitively know the power and the beauty of it, we might reach for it with a strong forcing current. So yeah, that's a really good analogy of where sex goes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, and please do ask questions if we want to go along, because I really appreciate your contributions. So on the next of the triad, looking at love, the guide says that love is a permanent state in the soul. And he also says that pure love does not exist on this planet. Again, you can read that as negative. What do you mean I don't have pure love? I have great love. All the guide is saying is you have human love at the height of its maturity and development. You have the most love that a human being can manifest, which is a great and wonderful thing. But, of course, the guide is talking of pure love, and he is speaking from a place that we are not embodied in. He is speaking of a larger container. So without being negative about the container we live in, which is the human plane, the guide is saying the full experience of pure love is something that a human being does not necessarily experience except during moments. Love also does not come at random. Love doesn't dart. Love is not a movement like sexual force or erotic force might be, or the force of eros, or the force of a number of things. That love would be more of an oozing. Love would be more of a state of being rather than the thing you do that manifests the love itself. So love does not come at random. It does not come and go depending on the quality of the person who is being loved. There was a quotation that I read at a ceremony once by Thich Nhat Hanh. And it says, true love contains respect. If you are motivated by some desire, that is not love. Desire is not love. And that's why the triad, the complete quality of loving relationship, needs to include the other elements as well. Love was not meant to be the only compartment, the only item in a relationship. A relationship is not being asked to support only love. But there are other forces that add to, that help love breathe, that help love stay alive, that help it develop to the fullness of its ability. So the other quality of love is that, like many other qualities that we are trying to develop, love is a matter of balance. Love is a matter of finding areas that don't work and strengthening and encouraging and creating a container for them. And at one point, what I loved about the lecture was the guide said, If you are out of balance in some quality, then part of the incarnatory process, which is a facet of path work, whether you accept it or not, is certainly up to you. But if you believe in the incarnatory process, which means we come back many times in our development as spirit, that if something is missing from you, you may come back in one lifetime, I'll use the word, the little lopsided, so that you can mature and advance and develop a part of you that is not yet fully developed. So that our lives as human beings are not the full spectrum of who we are. Our lives as human beings reflect what we have chosen to do on this small portion of unitive reality. That we as human beings are much bigger in spirit than we are how we appear at the moment. And that we may have manifested to learn a certain lesson that requires we be out of balance for a while, because the plan is that we want to come back into balance. So that being the element of love. And the reason I went through these other two so quickly is that I find the strongest teaching in this lecture to be about Eros. That's the one. That's the element that I have not found addressed as strongly or as beautifully in any other philosophy or any other lecture as it is in this one. So I'm a little enthusiastic because I find it delightful. So Eros, what is Eros? And the guide says that Eros is one of the most potent forces in the universe. He calls sex the creative force on any level of existence. But it's like Eros is the engine. Eros is what gets the creative force started. Eros is what starts the process of our learning to be in love. Now I'm going to take a 2-second break and do something technical. Thank you. So if you guys wonder sometimes why I keep having to interrupt, I film this and I record it alone, so if something needs my attention, I have nobody I can point to and say, go over there and fix that. So back to Eros. So as one of the most potent forces in the universe, Eros's job is to get us up and moving. That's its purpose. That's its entire point. So Eros gets us started, gets us up, gets us moving. And once that is in motion, once we are moving, then the next step in relationship, and whether that relationship is, like I tease, big R or little r, relationship with an individual, or relationship with a community, or relationship with your friends, or even on a spiritual level with your work and with God. Once Eros has got you up and running, the next step is to start building love, to start building that steady state, that permanent state in the soul of love. And because Eros's job is to get you moving and get you up and going, it naturally cannot last forever. Eros is like one of those lovely annual plants. It is designed to die so that it has the opportunity to be reborn. In other words, it's, once again, think of it like a flower. Think of it like an absolutely gorgeous flower, the plant stores up this energy and it sends up the shoots and it goes up with this bud and it makes this riotously gorgeous creation. It's not meant to be a permanent state. It's meant to allow itself to be fragile and colorful and beautiful, but then the horse or the donkey or the insect eats it or the person steps on it. And that's not the end. If the roots that support that plant have gone out into the earth and found nutrition and are ready to either go dormant for a while or just store up and wait until it's ready to send up another flower. you think of Eros as the flower. It is the penultimate point of some types of creation. But it is not supposed to be a permanent state. So balancing those two, balancing the energy and the glory and the wonder of Eros, and also holding that it is meant to fade and come back. Fade and come back. Eros is a cycle rather than a steady state. So the guide also speaks that Eros is a foretaste of unity. Eros is like an appetizer. Eros, you taste it and it's so wonderful and it's so great that you get a sense of what pure love might be, of what the unitive state might hold for you. And because of that taste, it develops a longing in us for that pure state, for love, and for the unitive. And it propels us to do the craziest things. It propels us to go out and find adventure. It propels us to move to a new location, to take on the difficulties of relationship. With all its beauty, relationship is hard to do. Eros is the one that gets us up in the morning and gets us activated and makes our eyes sparkle and lets us run over those speed bumps in the road that might hold us back. So it serves as a foretaste of the unitive state. It gives us just a nibble of what is possible, bringing out our longing as well for unity. But if it doesn't do what it's meant to do, which is to bridge the gap, to lead us towards the development of love, then when it fades, there's little or nothing left. So, Eros alone, what is Eros alone? If sex alone is utterly selfish, Eros alone is analogized as platonic love. So Eros alone is simply an enthusiasm to be with, to do, to engage, to participate. But you can feel it. There's what happens next? And when Eros fades and we come back, so if you think of Eros, if Eros leads you out the door to do things, and then when we're done or we get tired or the task is over, we come home. If there's nothing at home in our soul, in our emotional life, if there's nothing at home to come home to, then it can feel like Eros is gone and so is the sun. That without the flower, everything's over, everything's done. And yet if when we exercise Eros, we at the same time begin to build the building blocks, I'm repeating here a little bit, but we're putting together the building blocks of love and relationship. Or, for instance, the building blocks of career and profession. Or the building blocks of, I have Eros for a lovely home, and I went out and I spent some time in an area and really enjoyed it. Now I'm going to go home, I'm going to get on the phone, I'm going to start the hard work of doing whatever has to be done to create such a home for myself. In career, we get a chance to exercise our creative abilities on the job, and we decide, I'm going to go out and get a little bit more education because I loved that feeling. That was a wonderful sense of power and authority, and I want to earn it. I want to have the credentials. I want to have the teaching. I want to have the learning that I need, so that I can put my name forward and have more of that. So that I can turn around and you can feel the repetition in this. And these are just as valid as having Eros for a person and having a great time and enjoying them. And then when that fades off a little bit, and you're not so excited about this, but you have agreed to spend time and you have started the process of getting to know this person better, and that process will carry you, and then Eros has a chance to flower again so that you have another burst of enthusiasm about this relationship. So eros alone, being wonderful, but it doesn't necessarily build or create anything of lasting value. Now, because of that, you can probably see where eros and erotic is simply a strong force of eros, rather than thinking of it as lascivious or promiscuity or pornography. Erotic is putting a lot of energy into the force of eros so that its purpose is for its own benefit. So the erotic force on its own can be so exciting and so wonderful that when it begins to fade, we can have a tendency to want to go out and regenerate it, even if we're pushing a little bit. So the erotic force carries the beauty of eros. But if we simply insist that that's all we want, we may find that we're having to make it up, that we're having to synthesize it, that we're having to scramble to get events and circumstances to support another burst of eros. Because without the other two, without the creative force of sex or the creative force, and without love as a permanent state of unity, when all you've got is eros, then all you can look forward to is another burst of eros, and then another burst of eros. So it gets you up, it gets you out the door, it gets you excited, and then it's like you crash and burn after eros is gone. Instead of having used that time period to start to build the building blocks of a container to hold a more developed spirit, more pleasure in life, and companionship or a job or an artistic endeavor. So that's if you are only using eros. Now, there's another aspect to eros, and that is that if you overuse eros, and especially if you overuse eros coupled with the sex force, it is actually a way to avoid intimacy, because true intimacy comes from the quality of love. Eros is about getting and finding and wanting to keep love. The sex force is about being creative and active. But love is what's underpinning all these. So that if you focus only on eros, and especially if you couple it with the sex drive, you can have a cycle that goes very, very strongly on a continual basis, but it doesn't really get anywhere. And it can actually mask or prevent the very intimacy that it can look like it's seeking. On the other hand, if you love the erotic force and it's very exciting to you, and you are not afraid of where it leads you, you can spend a lot of time in an eros-filled environment. You can create a life that has a lot of eros over and over again in many, many different planes. And you can be very open to that experience without necessarily being open, again, to the experience of deep intimacy. There's something that people who have been married a long time learn, and that is you have to fall in love with that person over and over again. The falling in love meaning the eros element of love in a long-term relationship has to be rekindled, not kept, rekindled. So the force of eros in a long-term relationship or a long-term job or a long-term career, or a long-term series of relationships with friends, needs to be rekindled. And you can see where the creative force of sexuality, or creative force just by itself, needs to be swept into this. That's what's going to give eros its strength and its power and its enthusiasm. So the two ways of avoiding intimacy by using eros is one, to couple it with the creative force so that you've got a lot of drive and a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of energy, but you never get around to the love part. And the other is to revere Eros above all else and literally live in a pleasure world of Eros so that you are not called to build love and you do not incorporate the creative force. Interestingly, the guide says that Eros only exists in human beings. Whenever I read the lectures, I find these new sentences. I feel like sometimes somebody rewrote them and slipped them in on me while I wasn't looking, because I don't remember that part. But the guide says that Eros is something that is only available in the incarnatory process when we reach the development of being a human being. That dogs and horses and eagles don't have the force of Eros as we are talking about. So it is a basic difference between us and the animal and mineral world, that we have this fire and this ability to become passionate and aroused and leap tall buildings at a single bound and walk over mountains. But also that Eros is the main ingredient in the adventure of relationship. Now, this is where the guide goes into a specific discussion of marriage, which is a beautiful discussion. And again, you can feel a little bit left out if you're not in a marriage or a long-term relationship. But taking this both in the terms the guide talks about it, and in a larger context, that the spirit of adventure needs to exist in any long-term relationship of any kind. You need to rekindle the desire to go further, to listen, to speak, to share. A story that occurred to me when I was preparing for this, which I hope works, it sounds a little bit odd. A few weeks ago, I was driving with a friend, and the friend mentioned a part of my life that is not terribly pleasant, and then went on to talk about something else. And 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, they noticed that I had gone silent. And so my friend turned to me and said, "Did I upset you? Did I distract you? Did I bring up memories that you would prefer not to have?" And it was an act of love on my friend to notice and to feel called to reach out and say, "Is there something here? What happened?" Interestingly, on the other side, in my world instead of their world, what had happened to me was they had mentioned this one incident, which truly was not something I care to remember without some thought and some care. But they had accidentally mentioned a few sentences later another innocuous thing. They had mentioned the word seatbelt. And unknown to them, I had, as a passive good Samaritan, as a passerby, one time come across a bunch of teenagers who had been in a car that got overturned. And I had actually given mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to a 17-year-old boy who died. And while the one turn into memories that weren't pleasant, I heard that comment, and of course it activates certain things in you. But it was her comment a few sentences later about seatbelts that really sent me off into a world of concern and care. The end of that personal story is that I came home that day, and from that day forward, nobody in my household got in a car without seatbelts, and no one has ever gotten in my car without seatbelts on since that day, and that was at least 30 to 35 years ago. So I was swimming in that. The reason I mention it is this. That was an example to me once I experienced it, and we shared the information and laughed a little bit about where I'd gone and where they thought I had gone. That is an example of learning to know someone. There's no other way to know who someone is and what their experiences are, because we are not with another person every single day, every minute, every ounce of their life. Part of learning to love someone is learning who they are, what they think about, why certain things trigger certain memories. And I mention this because for me, because I collect little stories like this, so I bookmarked it and said, I'll use that. That little story was an example of deepening love between me and my friend. In that moment, we learned a little bit about each other in that very, very brief exchange. And I mentioned it, I chose that example partly because it's not particularly pleasant. The pleasure of love, the pleasure of sharing, the pleasure of being with someone does not necessarily have to have a smiley face put on it. Now, why do I mention that? And I'll go there in a second, but at this point I need to change the tape in the recorder.